The following is a collection of excerpts from eight of the most recent recipients of the Jeffrey E. Smith's Editor's Prize Award. Full texts are available on the Missouri Review's website.
Exit Seekers by Tamara Titus. Waking up to my sister's voice is a little like waking up naked under a streetlight. When it happens, you know some seriously bad shit has gone down. Angie's thighs press against the seam of her slacks. Now that she's pushing 50, she's starting to pack on the pounds. She sets the Starbucks cup on the tray table between us. I take a sip of the coffee, and it's almost as good as the drugs they're giving me. She even put real sugar in it. Marianne said you had second-degree burns. She tugs on her earring, a nervous tic she developed when we got sent to foster care. Angie protected me back then. That's what they tell me. She also said, your roommate's daughters are pretty upset. I close my eyes and count to 10. I know what she's thinking. She's worried somehow she'll get sued. Angie's never screwed up in her entire life. And even now, even after I've been clean for 2 years, she still keeps me at arm's length. He's not my roommate anymore. Did you give that man cigarettes, Ben? I didn't. But she won't believe me. Angie hasn't believed me since I took her Honda and totaled it when I was 15. I should have, I say, and I hold up my bandaged hand. I'm paying for it anyway, aren't I? The West Unit corridor feels 1,000 miles long now that I've only got one good hand. I try to talk to the physical therapy department into giving me a motorized chair, a hot rod to cruise around in until I heal up. But they said it would allow my upper body strength to degrade. I pass Ella on the main hall. She's got one hand on the rail and one hand on the collar of her nightgown. Bring me a drink of whiskey, she says. And for the first time in months, an ache comes over me. A need so strong it nearly blisters me inside. Marcus is loading the vending machines when I get there, and he hands me a Three Musketeers. Your friend's back, he says. I try not to make friends in this place, I tell him as I hand him my dollar. Everybody's got one foot in the grave already. Marcus laughs. Not you? We both look down at my stumps. No, not me.
Instructions to the Living from the Condition of the Dead by Jason Brown. And now he was forced to picture the man who had wedged his head under the wall of the barn and died with his eyes open to the sky. Had he seen that? The others they found in the smoldering piles by the doors. Following the trail of the destruction south, they found more charred bodies inside the barracks at Koffering. Skeletons with blackened skin stretched as tight as the heads of snare drums. Between Dachau and Tegernsee, more bodies in the woods and along the side of the road. Then they reached Tegernsee, and the tank commander with his bandage over one eye and another around his chest begged them not to shell the town where the murderers hid among the innocent. The SS is still there, John had said to the CO, Bill Spears. And a hospital and 12,000 people without guns, said the tank commander in perfect English. Dried blood flaked off his dirty neck. John remembered the German tank commander's hazel eyes, the chip in his tooth, the feel of the air, the impossibly blue sky as John held the handle of the radio in one hand and the crank in the other. Bill Spears raised his palm and shook his head. Later, they walked into the town with the tank commander. The SS had left already, and thousands of people, many of them children, mothers, grandmothers, wounded soldiers, all the people they would have killed, came out to greet them. Many people were dying in these last days of the war, Germans and prisoners both. Hundreds and thousands in the camps died of typhus before and after they were rescued. Many German villagers not killed by the constant Allied firebombing committed suicide just before the Americans or Soviets arrived. I know, Isabel said. We are all supposed to think. Walter and I, we just never believed any of that, at least not in the way we were told it happened.
The Wall by Emma Tersch. Yet despite my frantic heart, we made it past security without a hassle. There were two gun-strapped young men operating the X-ray machine through which I fed my backpack, and they seemed both more and less alert than I was used to. More alert to the prospect of violence, but less interested in me as a body, their eyes flicking over me incuriously in a steady non-gaze. Behind me, Eva said something in Hebrew, and all three of them laughed. "You see," said Eva, herding me toward the mouth of a small tunnel. "They're looking for weapons, metal, not for cross-dressing American girls." By this time, the sun had set completely, and we came out onto a crowded stone plaza that glowed under yellow floodlights, thick with tourists and armed soldiers and head-scarfed groups of teenage girls. Everyone moved as if in schools on the same tide, drifting closer to the lit-up stone facade of the wall. Though it was straighter and more focal than the other walls of Old Jerusalem, at first it seemed smaller than I'd imagined. I could see the dark points of trees growing on a slope behind it. But then we drew closer, and it began to tower over us. It was very old, and you could feel its age. Here and there some greenery had sprouted from the pale limestone bricks and clung like floating bushes, with white birds darting between. We walked to the metal and mesh partition that portioned out the space before the wall like a stage. People filed in through the wide paths on either side. "There's the entrance for the women," said Eva, "and here is the men's." The women's side, the right side, was smaller by more than a third. While the men were shouting and singing and dancing, sending up a great noise, the women made barely a sound. "We're not permitted to pray out loud," said Eva. "You shouldn't either. They'll hear your voice and know. So look, your brother was there toward the end, and he put his paper into the rock about here." She tapped her shoulder, chest height for me, and it occurred to me to wonder how she knew this. She must have been watching him. Wishing she could join him? Wondering, as I did, what he'd prayed for? "I'll wait for you here," said Eva. "You're not going in on the women's side?" Her arms were crossed, her gaze distant. "Been there, done that," she said. How to Walk on Water by Rachel Swearingen. There was no sign of forced entry. Sigrid told the officer she might have forgotten to lock the door. They knew Wilkes's profile, knew his victim type, petite, new mother, what they later described as a reluctant Madonna type. By then they had gathered a list of women who had disappeared from the area, but they had only circumstantial evidence linking them to Wilkes, and no bodies, yet. When Sigrid was out during the day, Nolan watched TV and took long baths. He stole 20s from a soapbox his mother hid in her dresser and felt like a teenager again. He had no money, just what little she gave him for spending. In his suitcase, he had two blank checks from her desk. He just needed a few weeks to clear his head. If things worked out, he'd tear them up and she'd never know. If not, he'd cash them on the way out of town. He kept a six-pack of cheap beer in the refrigerator and replaced what he drank before Sigrid returned in the evening. One afternoon, he tried to recreate the aftermath of the attack by pulling himself out of the tub and crawling across the tile. He hadn't gotten very far. He only managed to scrape his knees and scare the cat. When Sigrid came home, she said, "What's this water all over the floor? Did you spill something?" He told her he had taken a bath and forgotten his towel, and she had looked at him queerly and said, "There's a shower right next to your room." In the Seattle Times online archives, Nolan found an article from when Wilkes was put away for Sigrid's assault and rape in 84. In the picture, his face was boyish, his blonde hair thinning, and he had dull, close-set eyes. If Nolan had passed Wilkes on the sidewalk, he would have never given him a second glance. They had failed to get Wilkes on attempted murder. He was out on parole 8 years later, lived just hours from Sigrid for 20 more years, until he was finally convicted of the murder and dismemberment of a young woman in Coeur d'Alene, Idaho. He'd confessed to killing 6 others, though investigators believe there were many more. Nolan was in Colorado when he heard the news, and he'd called his mother. She told him detectives had been visiting her for years, trying to put Wilkes away. She'd said this like it was just another piece of passing news.
Consider This Case by Melissa Yancey. It is hard to clearly remember his parents on a holiday morning. The memory of his own anticipation is stronger. He remembers running downstairs without using the bathroom, trying hard not to pee on the floor by the Christmas tree. He can see the extravagance of the house, perfectly decorated with old-fashioned ornaments his father liked. Lace snowflakes, golden orbs, wooden Santas carrying trees. He can see his father leaning forward in his high-backed chair that he positioned near the tree, while his mother sat with her legs tucked up beneath her on the end of the couch. "I can't complain about this view," his father says, "although it could get lonely looking out at this." "It does," Julian admits. "Trees make me feel insulated," his father says. "You and your sister always had a higher tolerance for loneliness. In different ways. She's surrounded by people, of course, but there's no lonelier life. Jay was always more like me, looking for something to fill it." His father never speaks of Jay, and certainly not in relation to himself. "I hadn't thought of it that way," Julian says carefully. "As you two being alike." "Unfortunately for Jay, I'm afraid so," he says. "But you, the work you do, I don't know what kind of person one has to be to do that. It frightens me. I thought it was crazy enough when you decided to study gynecology." Julian tells his father about the pacemaker, about the federal funding he could get. He does not fill in the gaps or explain that he researches on sheep. He tells him instead what it could mean for the babies. "The lengths a person will go to bring a child into this world," his father says, "is the only thing that still astonishes me. People are so predictable in other matters, but not this." He is looking out at the water, the rim of the cup grazing his lips. Julian feels he has stepped into a private moment that perhaps he shouldn't be witnessing. "Look at me, for example," his father says. "Consider this case."
"The Blood Was the Mountain, and the Mountain Was the Bear," by Rachel Yoder. Its claws had the look of something prehistoric, something made more of rock and ore than of flesh and blood. This was a creature forged from the remains of other animals, from beaks and teeth and hides. It could not have not been born. "So in Scandinavian folklore, they think people can turn into bears," Osha said, standing at the head of the covered pile, motioning to Elliot. He raised the tarp to show him the bear's face. "They used to have these ceremonies after a bear was killed where the fur was treated with herbs and oils and then given to warriors. It was supposed to make them able to chew through shields, stuff like that. That's all I can think about when I see something like this. Such a shame." Elliot turned to the body as if in a dream. Its head rested on a pile of dirty towels seeping gore, the fading edges of which formed a pink corona around the animal's skull. A clean hole broke through the head, just beneath the ears, in layers of dark fur and bright bone, and further in, shades of red and gray and beige. The fur covered it, shiny and thick and soft, like a toy. The bear looked nothing like the idea of a bear. "Could you imagine if this were a person?" Osha said. "Imagine." Elliot nodded. "The claws. They could go straight in your arm and out the other side." "It doesn't really seem..." Here Elliot paused. "Could a mountain die? Could gold?" it doesn't really seem dead, in a way. Osha looked at him, then took the tarp in silence and raised it higher to reveal the trunk of the animal. "They'll cut into it and try to find the remains," Osha said. "But the body has to be under lock and key, you know, since there's such a demand for black market gallbladders. Like any of us would do such a thing." Black teats peeked through the fur. Elliot took a step back. "What about the cubs?" he asked. Osha winced. "They'll fend for themselves as best they can, I suppose. Worst case scenario, a male finds them and eats them. But that's worst case." "Jesus," Elliot said, staring at the animal's coat, which shone almost red in the downing sun. The luxury of its colors and furs and snout and tongue all descended on Elliot at once, and quite suddenly, it was as if the queen herself had been laid out here before him in her heavy pomp. It was the end of everything. The kingdom was set to storm, or at the very least turn dark and strange.
The Long Net by Anna Solomon. Behind my mother's house, even my father called our house, was my mother's garden. And next to the garden was what would have looked to a trespasser, we rarely had guests, like a smaller garden all of tulips. If you looked closely, though, you could see among the tulips two stones, found at the stony beach out on the point, which marked the graves of my mother's stillborn babies. Boys. They'd come after me when I was 2 and when I was 3. Too young to remember, people said, though I felt I did. I had an image of my mother crying on the stairs, the top of her blonde head bobbing in her hands, her hands dripping tears, though never in my known life had I seen her cry. People said at least I had come first. She had that as comfort. Adults said things to me they might not have said to other children, I suppose because they didn't feel they could say them to my mother. I felt their veracity and their surreptitious joy that it had not happened to them. I wasn't certain I was a comfort to my mother. Sometimes it seemed like I only reminded her of what she would have called her indulgence, that she had not thought to be satisfied. And my name reminded her, too, for both of the boys had died in June. Each fall, after it was cold, but before the first frost, there would be a Sunday morning when my mother headed out the back door, off the kitchen, with her kitchen thermometer in hand. She wore a kerchief on her head, not one of her usual bandana prints, but a brightly striped silk scarf I never saw at any other time. She knelt down near the gravestones and poked the thermometer into the ground, then sat there, hands on her knees, still as a statue. Last year, I dared myself to run out there and ask what she was doing. My mother startled, then laughed. "Nothing," she said. She folded her arms, holding an elbow in each hand, rubbing gently. My mother is the only person I've known who folded her arms that way. Always. Utterly self-contained. She said, "There's no proof anywhere that this works at all." But she didn't pull the thermometer out of the ground right away. She waited for me to leave, then waited some more. Then she pulled it out and held it up to read the temperature. She was satisfied and planted her tulips.
Exotic Animal Medicine by Fiona McFarlane. Noises came from Mr. Ronald's throat now, and these sounds seemed accidental, the byproduct of something else. They continued past the point Sarah was certain he had died. They rattled on in the can of his throat. Sometime after they had subsided, she became aware of the sound of a radio playing. In her own car, or this one? Who could Douglas be? A son? A grandson? Sarah was unsure of how long she had been sitting beside Mr. Ronald, and how long it had been since he had stopped making any sound at all. Gently, she laid his head back against the seat. His wife cleaned the walls of their shower, and he had been to see orangutans in Berlin. He was too young to have been in that war. Without warning, David filled up the space in the passenger door of Mr. Ronald's car. She had been so certain she would hear his footsteps on the road, but he was here in the door, as if she'd summoned him out of the field. I'm sorry, I didn't find anyone. He was wet, and his breath came quickly. I ran and finally found a house, but there was no one home. I thought about breaking in. Kept going for a bit, but no sign of life. No cars on the road even. So I headed back to try the car again. He looked at the stillness of the man in the driver's seat. He saw the blood on Mr. Ronald's trousers and the way that it crept towards his belt and shirt, and searched for blood on Sarah. Sarah concentrated carefully on David's face, which swam in the noise of the rain and the radio and the end of the vodka. My husband. Then she placed the wallet in Mr. Ronald's lap. Sarah moved to step out of the car, and David made space for her. How is he? Has he woken up? When a cat died during an operation, when it was necessary for a macaw to die, then Sarah must tell its owners. That was difficult to do. And so, along with the truth, she added other, less true things. That the tumor caused no pain, that the animal hadn't been frightened to go under anesthetic. Still, it was difficult. It made no difference to Sarah that words were inadequate to her enormous task. Of course they were. There might be a time when she would have to tell her friends, Sheba's owners, that he wouldn't survive his infection.